The new unemployment rate is 9.5%.
If only the news stopped there.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, July 2nd. The government said this morning the U.S. economy lost jobs in June, yet the unemployment rate improved a little. What gives?
Could the U.S. economy be getting a boost from the World Cup?
No, it could not.
No. And all the good business news summed up in a Marketplace Minute, good news being a relative term. But first,
the U.S. Labor Department said this morning America's unemployment rate dropped. It improved in June from 9.7 to 9.5%, even though the economy lost more than 100,000 jobs. Let's explain this. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial joins us every Friday live from New York. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Why did the unemployment rate fall if we lost jobs?
Well, unfortunately, what happened is that in June, about 500,000 people stopped looking for work. So we had a big rise in what we call discouraged workers. And because of the way the unemployment rate is calculated, they only look at the number of unemployed as a percentage of those who are actually either looking for work or working.
500,000 people stopped looking for work? Let's think about that for a moment. If you've truly given up looking, you won't find work. Is that as troubling a development as it sounds?
Well, it's not quite as bad as it sounds because this comes from a part of the survey that's not as rigorous as the rest. You do sometimes get these big, weird outlier numbers. But, yeah, you know, it tells you people are discouraged. And remember, we're a consumer-based economy. When people are worried about their jobs, they're not spending money. That's important.
Let's talk about the economy losing about 125,000 jobs in June. Now, we've been warning listeners to some extent that temporary census jobs were going to go away, and they did. So overall, how bad is that number?
Yeah, and in fact, the drop in census workers was exactly as expected. You take that out, and what you're left with was a growth in private payrolls of 83,000. So that's obviously a lot better than a big drop. But at the same time, what we see is that job growth has slowed significantly since the first part of the year. On top of that, there was a drop in hours worked, and even more troubling, a drop in hourly pay. So in a lot of ways, people are worse off in June than they were in May.
Chris, we have just a few seconds. President Obama talked about the employment report a few minutes ago, said the economy is headed in the right direction. Is it?
It is. It is still growing, but I'd argue that it's growing a lot less quickly than it was in the first quarter.
Thank you so much, Chris Lowe at FTN Financial.
You're welcome.
And for more analysis on this morning's jobs report, let's check with Professor James Angel from Georgetown University. He's with us from D.C. this morning. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
All right. Well, there are a lot of mixed signals coming out of this report this morning. What's the most important thing you think we should be looking at?
Well, I look at private sector payroll employment. We gained 83,000 jobs in the private sector.
What should we take away from all this?
It's a slow recovery. Yeah, it would take almost 10 years at this rate to absorb all the unemployed.
Wow. All right. Professor James Angel joining us from Georgetown University. Thank you, sir.
You're quite welcome.
Just a moment ago, you heard Chris Lowe say 500,000 people dropped out of the labor force in June. For more on that, we turn to Heidi Shearholtz, who tracks this phenomenon at the Economic Policy Institute. Hi, Heidi.
Good morning.
What's behind these numbers?
These numbers point to a serious and ongoing weakness in the labor market. So excluding changes in temporary census hiring, we are now adding jobs, but at an excruciatingly slow rate. It's just not fast enough to put the millions of unemployed workers in this country back to work anytime soon, so people are getting discouraged and dropping out.
Why are so many people discouraged?
So job seekers get discouraged and give up looking for work when they realize the search is futile. Right now, there are 5 unemployed workers for every job opening, so the chance that an unemployed worker will find a job in this climate is very small. Nearly half of all unemployed workers have been unemployed for over half a year, and the unemployment rate is expected to hover around 10% for at least the next 9 months.
If people, Heidi, keep dropping out of the labor force, I'm curious about this. I mean, they're not getting unemployment benefits. I mean, how are people getting by?
That's a very good question. So unemployment insurance is a huge part of the U.S. safety net. So once a worker exhausts their benefits, as millions will do over the course of this year, it's actually not clear to me how they and their families are going to get by. They can access food stamps and food banks. If they have kids, they may have access to welfare benefits. But the safety net is very thin. So there's going to be a lot of dependence on friends and family, a lot of people dropping into poverty. This is just, it's going to create a huge amount of chaos and hardship in the lives of people whose main fault was to be laid off during the worst recession in 70 years.
Well, some reality right there. All right, Heidi Shierholz from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
It isn't just the job market that has been struggling either. This week, we've also learned that housing and home construction are on the ropes. And surprisingly, that has meant that for the first time, the charity Habitat for Humanity is now considered one of America's top 10 home builders. First time that's happened. Marketplace's Janet Babin is with us live. Hi, Janet.
Hey, Bill.
How does Habitat for Humanity rank?
Well, it ranked 8th in Builder Magazine's top 10 list of builders, the Wall Street Journal reports today. So, number 8, not too bad for a Christian nonprofit started some 30 years ago to help low-income families achieve the American dream.
And how has a charity beat out some of the biggest home builders in the country?
Well, new homes just aren't selling in this economy, right? New home sales fell 32% in May, the lowest level ever. Nicholas Retsinas is director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University.
In a sense, it's very simple arithmetic. Habitat's numbers keep growing, though slightly. The larger builders' numbers keep falling, and as a result, Habitat moves up the list.
So does this, Janet, mean that Habitat for Humanity is now a major player?
Well, Habitat for Humanity certainly filled a niche that other home builders had been ignoring up until now, affordable housing. But Nick Retsinas says that's changing and that national builders are beginning to respond to that need with smaller new homes and more affordable options.
Marketplace's Janet Babin. Janet, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 2nd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. The new healthcare.gov insurance website has just been launched, and already companies are jockeying to upgrade it to a version that will let you comparison shop for health insurance. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner reports.
Type your zip code into the healthcare.gov website launched yesterday. You can see all the insurance plans available to you. That information's never been public, says Deanne Friedholm of Consumers Union, which publishes Consumer Reports.
They will be able to now build upon this to actually include information that will be even more helpful to consumers.
Such as how much are premiums and what really do those plans cover? That information hits the site in October. eHealthInsurance.com, the online broker, is bidding for the contract to design those comparison tools. So is Destination Rx, the company that provides software on the Medicare website to compare prescription drug plans. Vice President Jim Yocum says that within weeks after those tools went public in 2006,
we saw prices flatten for dozens of brand name drugs.
He says insurance premiums may even out somewhat, but comparing premiums is harder because insurance companies can still price you differently based on your medical history. They can do that until 2014. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 2nd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The Obama administration announced today nearly $800 million to expand broadband web access to rural and poor areas across this country. Tech advocates, though, want the president to go further, asking him to make such access a legal right. That very thing happened in one Scandinavian country this week. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports for Marketplace.
Finland is already one of the most internet-connected nations in the world. More than 90% of its 5 million people have access to high-speed broadband. But some of the country's rural areas are excluded or have a poor quality service. And that's the point of the new legal right. Every Finn must be provided with a reasonably fast broadband connection wherever they live. Suvi Linden is Finland's Minister of Communications.
We've seen that proper communication links are no longer luxury products, but necessary tools in day-to-day life. And that means that in Finland we have been developing e-services for citizens that they can use in their daily life.
It's also more cost-efficient for the government to provide public services online, like paying taxes or applying for benefits. But that only works if everyone has reliable web access. Internet service providers have been gearing up for the change, and according to the communications minister, only about 4,000 homes in the most remote regions still need to be connected. They should be online within the next couple of months, but it'll take wireless technology, not cables, to reach them. In London, I'm the BBC's Mark Gregory for Marketplace.
Plans for a massive tax on mining profits in Australia have been scaled back. The proposal was so controversial it actually helped give the Prime Minister there the boot. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the latest for us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Tell us about this massive tax.
This was an additional 40% tax on mining company profits proposed by the former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Now, mining is one of Australia's biggest, most buoyant industries. The country is often described as the quarry of the world, and especially of China. It's so profitable in Australia that it helped the country sail through the global crisis without slipping into recession. So this 40% levy looked at the time like a perfect tax.
And if it was so perfect, Stephen, what happened?
Well, the mining companies didn't like it. They reacted with fury. They threatened to pull out of Australia some of their operations. They mounted a really vigorous TV ad campaign, and the Prime Minister came off worse. His popularity slumped, and he was ousted last week. Justin Urquhart-Stewart of London fund manager Seven Investments says the Prime Minister seriously miscalculated.
The Australians look upon the mining companies, I suppose, their big global success. This is their big corporations, and so they are really rather proud of them.
And they're nervous about damaging one of their main sources of income and employment. The mining companies have said that the old tax proposal would have turned Australia into the most expensive country in the world for them to operate in. Under the new, much reduced plan, some but not all of the companies will be paying a bit more than they were before.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting live for us from London this morning. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
The World Cup quarterfinals are underway in South Africa, and soccer fans here in the United States continue to find places to tune in. To capitalize, pubs and eateries are kicking up their marketing. Reporter Rachel Dornhelm has more.
La Lola Tapas bar chef Gonzalo del Castillo says he's not usually over the stove midday, but he and his partners decided to open for lunchtime World Cup games, like this one, where Spain is playing Portugal. In the dining room of a small restaurant, about 15 or 20 soccer fans clutch sangria and beer, including Olivia Martin and Javier Hermida, who wear red and yellow Spanish soccer jerseys.
We saw a Spanish flag outside, and we knew Spain was playing today, so that's how we got here.
Chef owner Gonzalo del Castillo says he doesn't expect he'll end up covering the overhead from his extended hours for the World Cup, but he thinks customer loyalty is being built up during these games.
You know, it was a good marketing tool, and, you know, we're on the map for some people that didn't know us before.
Del Castillo's efforts have paid off with soccer fan Mike Salerno.
He's been in here. He's been mainly around the crowd, making sure everyone's having a good time.
The situation is similar about five blocks away at the Irish pub Kells. They've been opening at 7 a.m. for the first game of the day. During this lunchtime game, there are few open seats.
Anything else to drink?
At one table, Swiss fan Luke Meyer says bars showing the whole World Cup mean a lot to enthusiasts.
Big point of watching soccer during the World Cup is really the sort of social experience, and then you tend to just go to bars where it's lively and just share it with
passion.
Other people.
When I track down Kell's owner, he says the boost in food and drink sales may not be enough to cover the extra labor and some new flat-screen TVs he got for the World Cup. Still, he says the marquee games are yet to come. And if everything goes the way it did 4 years ago, it may be a very good month for the bar. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
This week, Dana College in Blair, Nebraska, said it will shut its doors after more than a century in business. A for-profit education company was about to buy the struggling college, but investors backed out when they learned the school would lose something very valuable, accreditation. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott explains.
In higher education, accreditation is like a golden key. It unlocks the door to millions of dollars in federal financial aid. Kevin Kinzer teaches education policy at the State University of New York at Albany. He says for-profit companies have been buying that golden key by buying struggling schools.
If they wanted to get accreditation by starting an institution from scratch, it would take several years, and they don't want to wait that long.
Officials are cracking down on so-called accreditation shopping. This week, the Higher Learning Commission, a regional accrediting agency, refused to transfer Dana College's seal of approval to its prospective buyers. Sylvia Manning is the agency's president.
Accreditation doesn't attach to a campus or a set of buildings. It attaches to programs and practices and faculty.
For-profit companies often change those programs, shifting to online courses. Dana's closure will leave 600 or so students looking for other options. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
4th of July weekend will be a hopping time for Washington, D.C. tour guides. There is big money in showing visitors the monuments and museums. The city government just made it easier to become a tour guide, which has some of them feeling threatened. From WAMU in Washington, D.C., Rebecca Shear reports.
Carolyn Crouch has been leading tours in D.C. since 1998.
So I'm actually going to have us start and look at Heritage Trail sign number one. Then we're going to make our way north down 4th Street.
She says applying for a license was quite the paper chase.
It was almost as document intensive as what I had to do to adopt my daughter from Vietnam.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Fellow tour guide Tim Krepp agrees.
That was a very broken Byzantine process.
Krepp says to get licensed, you had to attest to a whole slew of things.
Most notably that you're not a drunkard, or I believe the doctor had to do that.
The notarized doctor's note also had to vouch for your hearing and vision, and that you didn't have things like epilepsy and heart disease. Finally, aspiring guides had to prove they were an American citizen who can read, speak, and write English. All those requirements are gone. And nixing that last rule worries Maricar Donato, who's been guiding in D.C. nearly 30 years.
They're going to remove that law about the U.S. citizenship. That's not good because they're stealing my job.
But chances are her livelihood will be safe. Donato leads prep classes for the D.C. license exam, which tests your savvy on history, buildings, monuments.
True or false, the Washington National Zoo is one of the 19 Smithsonian museums.
True.
The city still will require guides to pass that test. But Carolyn Crouch applauds D.C. for easing the other guidelines. Unlike Donato, she says the relaxed rules shouldn't hurt tour guides or tourism.
I don't think that's going to decrease the number of people who come to visit. And there's more than enough people for a big cadre of tour guides.
What's important, she says, is that those guides are excited, passionate, and, of course, knowledgeable. Which brings us to that test question about the National Zoo. It's not considered one of the 19 Smithsonian museums because, technically, it's a research center. Next time you're touring D.C., see if you can try and stump your guide with that one. In Washington, I'm Rebecca Shear for Marketplace.
And finally, here is the entire week's business news in a Marketplace Minute. We were going to pay for financial reform with a tax on the banks who created the storm. Instead, the money will come from, I swear, the bailout fund, because that seems fair. The recovery is tiring. Nobody's hiring. There's something new wrong with Toyota's wiring. Let's see. World Cup. The Americans lose. I'm trying to find some positive news. Oh, the oil spill's fixed. Nah, I'm just teasing. It's spewing like hell and it's hurricane season. Supreme Court squashes the handgun ban. I guess that's good for a firearm fan. You know what? These headlines are leaving me flat. It's a three-day weekend. Let's focus on that. Have fun with your sparklers and Francis Scott Key, and I'll see you at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.